5:15, the Developmental Disabilities Advisory Board is now open. Do we have, Mary, do we have a quorum?
Yes.
All right. Then the first order of business, as usual, is community input. Do we have any community input?
Well, I think we might. So you guys have already received, but I wanted to pass out to the audience the Advocacy Day flyers. And I will be giving an update later on the agenda on our candidates forum. But we really want to get people paying attention and signed up for our Advocacy Days. We'll be going up to Olympia every Wednesday and several other days. And we would love to take you up to meet your newly elected legislators and work on some new bills and laws. Fix them all.
Darla, how many people usually show up at those?
On Advocacy Day?
Yeah.
It depends on the day. So like the employment rally day is usually pretty heavily attended. It's not uncommon to have like 120 to 150 people there from across the state. The legislative reception is February 1st, and that's also Supported Employment Day, and both of those are highly attended. Would be an excellent day to show up. We're trying to make sure all the legislators attend that.
So how many parent coalition groups do you have around the state?
There are 14 parent coalition groups representing 19 different counties around the state. It's approximately about 55,000 families across Washington State that are members of Parent Coalition.
Thanks, Dr. Any other community input? Then we'll move to special orders. Darren, you have a special order to talk to us about community first waivers. Thanks. What a sense, I'm just reading from the agenda here. Darren.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for having me. Everyone, let me pass this one out. So for those I'm not familiar with, my name is Aaron Stengel. I work for Developmental Disability Administration and I'm out of our local office here in Vancouver. I am in a somewhat new position. For those of you who know me, I used to be supervising out of the office, also helps to work closely with the county. I'm now helping head up and program manage for our Community First Choice program. So that program is a program that I help manage for our region, for the DDA region. So when I was talking with Trish, she said, why don't we come by and talk about that program a little bit and make sure you guys have that information. So I said, I'd be glad to. So Community First Choice is a relatively new program for DDA. It was started in July of 2015. So before that, what we had was Medicaid Personal Care. And Medicaid Personal Care may sound familiar to you, and that is the caregiver support, where the caregiver comes into the home to help our clients with the different activities of daily living that they have. And so when we got an opportunity to look at that program and how we could further enhance it, that's how Community First Choice came to be, as we looked at the opportunity and some of the models that we had in some of the other states, and they were able to create a program that offered a little more variety of services beyond just that caregiver or that personal care support. And then that's how CFC came to fruition. So as you can see with CFC, it has many different services. Besides just the personal care, which is that top one, and I'll talk just a little bit about each one and make sure you understand those. But we have, the cool thing about CFC was that it created that expansion of what was just that personal care. Now it's these other services that we've offered to. Like I said, relatively new, so wanting to continue to get word out, continue to share what services there are that this program can provide. For this program,
can you first say who's eligible for this?
That was my next thing. Thanks, Dad. So as far as eligibility goes for Community First Choice, it's anybody that has Medicaid or has Apple Health in our state system receiving some state medical assistance. So anybody that has that, essentially they're more likely going to meet the financial requirement that we have. One of the other ways that you can get onto CFC, Community First Choice, is through one of our waiver programs. So I know many of you are aware of our waiver programs. Judy Miller came to the meeting 2 months ago and spoke about our IFS waiver program, which we're trying to really get a boost in enrollment in. And if you're in one of our waiver programs, you're automatically eligible for Community First Choice as well. So, did that answer your question?
Thank you.
And it is for all populations.
All ages, yeah. Yep. There's no restriction other than maybe that finance component. So, yeah. So we can talk a little bit about these different services. So you can see where can you receive these services in your own home, an adult family home, or assisted living facility. So those are the areas in which we're going to authorize and give you CFC. So the first one is personal care, okay? And like I mentioned, that's the caregiver support. That's a caregiver that comes in your home and helps you with your activities of daily living. And there's an allotment of hours each month that the client can divide into a schedule for that provider to come. And that's our core service.
Now, allotment is determined based on economic situation or what?
Good question, Walt. Allotment is based off of the assessment. Every client has a DDA assessment that's done. That assessment determines level and then less hours. So personal care, that's our core service. That's the main service. That's what it originally derived as. And then we now have these ancillary services as well. And you guys have any questions about any of the services, stop and they can answer a question. So one of the other newer services, one of the newer services is caregiver management training. And this is simply some material in either written or video form for our clients that can help give them some education around how to hire, how to fire, how to manage that caregiver, because they're the employer in that relationship. So none of them necessarily have all the education to know how do I manage my employee and my individual who I'm responsible for making those decisions and helping them. So that's just some, it's a simple written or video form of documentation that provides some education to them. We also have relief care. Relief care is an opportunity for them to have more than one provider. And in essence, by having more than one provider, the primary provider gets some relief. In other words, you know, you can move some of those hours around and be able to allot some of those hours to this other provider, thus providing some relief care for the primary provider.
Is there the limit, the overtime limit? Because didn't we have a budget item last year around that?
Yes. All individual providers have new overtime limitations and work week limitations. And each provider has information around what their work week limit is. Sometimes that includes over 40 in overtime, sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. So each provider does need to work within those work week limitations.
And are you recruiting?
Providers, like individual providers? Yeah. We're recruiting all kinds of providers, just like we're recruiting providers for the IFS waiver services. And yeah, we're constantly recruiting. We have a regional team now that was developed recently to really do a lot of both the professional as well as the individual providers. So yeah. If you guys know of anybody,
is there a shortage?
Yeah, there's always a shortage. Always a shortage of every type of provider. So if you guys know anybody that's interested in being any type of provider, whether that's a professional provider or an individual provider, you know, talk to them about becoming a DDA provider. We'd love to have them.
So that's interesting because I'm a special education teacher in Camas, and one of my teaching colleagues has been in the process of applying to provide respite care for some students and former students.
Okay.
And she said the system is very difficult to navigate. It's not, the system is not communicating. She's in the system, but she's not been approved and this and that. It's been chaotic. Because what we were talking about at my meeting here was the challenges of families face trying to figure out how to work through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, came up with acronyms and language and the way things are written and the difficulty in understanding that. So it's good to know that there's going to be hope for her when she finally gets through and gets everything. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what's happening, but it sounds like one hand isn't talking to the other.
Yeah. Are you recommending the easier process?
I'm recommending that, yeah, the language be simplified and processes be simplified. So it's, I also have a parent whose son is aging out and he doesn't have a caseworker.
Yeah.
And that's, I think the school district needs to own some of that responsibility too, but, and part of it is it's intimidating for her, it's overwhelming, you know,
But if he's aging out, he could.
He's turning 29, he doesn't have his career.
Yeah, but this is still a year. He could get services.
Yeah.
Through the, you know, be on the waiver and get services.
Yeah.
Position.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really important that they get signed up.
Oh, yeah. I had a long conversation with him, but a lot of it is just, it's intimidating. It's daunting. Mm-hmm. It's humiliating. Preaching to the fire here. It's hard to get through. Yeah.
Parent Coalition can help them fill out the paperwork and hold their hand.
I told her all about you guys.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't forget to do that.
Yeah, if you can get them through the front door, you know.
Yeah.
Darla and her crew will help. We'll help. You know, we want to get them into eligibility first, and then look at what services we can
do.
And, you know, if I can address just a little bit, Susan, the piece about providers and getting finalized and all that stuff. We do have two components. You've got a component of contracting and a component of training.
Uh-huh.
And years ago, they decided that those were going to be separate. Entities, and that's where there's always challenges when you have multiple entities handling one, you know, goal, one focus. So that's some of the challenges we're aware of, and we continue to strive to, you know, make those better. So, but thank you for sharing.
Yes.
Okay, so we talked about relief care, skills acquisition training. This is cool. This is where they can access some of those hours or a separate small allotment of funds to have someone come in and assist them with those caregiving tasks, in a very intentful focus on building their skills. So, in other words, creating independence around those activities of daily living. Their job is not to just perform or do the task, but it's to actually train and help them gain that life skill and independence around that area that we're focusing on. So with skills acquisition training, it's not personal care, it's a separate service. It looks somewhat similar because it's still an individual provider coming into the home or the living situation and helping them, but their focus is specifically, for example, like I'm going to help them learn how to brush their teeth and really focus on that, whereas a regular caregiver under the personal care service, the core of what they're doing is making sure that it's performed and done.
If there's an adaptive device or if there's a need to make modifications to allow for the skill to be acquired, is that something that you would help with? You know, what I immediately think of looking at the picture you have here is if a platform was to be introduced to that cooking island, if that would be something that you would provide in order for that skill to be learned.
And that's the next service I'm going to talk about.
Oh, okay.
Yep, so the back. That's right. So you're just one step ahead.
With the skills acquisition, how are we doing with recruiting providers, and how are those providers being trained to do the skills acquisition?
Well, here's the great thing about skills acquisition. If you're currently an IEP, you can do it. You just have to get a small designation change done in your contract, and you're good to go. So we can use our current pool of providers, and they can receive the information around how it's different in that training, and then they can get that designation, and then they can do it.
Is there any specific training?
You know, I'm not clear on the exact training or whatnot. I believe they decided that the training that they get to be a caregiver is enough with education when they get that designation. I believe that's what's happening. So.
Can someone take like a cooking class to learn how to cook?
Well, anybody can take a cooking class, I'm sorry. Maybe.
Well, instead of paying a provider, can they buy a class?
No.
Okay.
Not in the service. So. Any more questions on skills acquisition? Okay, so Walt was asking about, is there assistive tech or anything that can be utilized in this program? Yes, that's also one of the services. So we also have a small allotment of funds that can be used. That's funds in the amount of $500 per fiscal year that can be used to help pay for or get them a assistive tech piece that would be benefiting them, specifically around activities of daily living or independent activities of daily living. So they needed that platform for their meal prep or something like that. That's one example of something that potentially we could.
So let's change it to an iPad, and the iPad costs $1,000. So could they put up $500 and then you would put up the other $500 match as your $500 maximum for animal?
Great question. That comes up all the time because iPads are a big one right now. That's one of our actually main ones that are getting a lot of use. The answer to yours is, can they private pay and we cover the difference? No. CMS and the federal rules don't allow us to do that. But we do have an exception process where we can exceed that $500 in a fiscal year for a particular device that exceeds that amount. So it's common right now that, you know, the iPad itself and maybe the application that goes with it, like the ProLoco Go, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of combination is going to cost, say, like $800. Mm-hmm. So we can do an exception, ask for an additional $300, and most often those are getting approved. So
my son was offered an iPad, some programs, but what you say in the next paragraph is very important. They said you have to go get a doctor's signature.
Yes.
That's one. And then our doctor changed because then the next appointment is like 2 months away. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of important that you get
there's
a lead time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's steps, there's requirement pieces that we have in our Washington.
It's just fine. Code.
Reminding people. And there's, I mean, within each one of these, there's little criteria things that you know have to meet. So, you know, if you're going to access it, that client and family just needs to be talking to the case manager and then get all the information around what the exact criteria is. So, one of the keys with Community First Choice is it can't be anything. And I will share one quick example. Somebody came to me the other day and said, well, I want this application for a job, I want an iPad and this application for future employment. I also want it for educational so he can learn more educational skills. That wouldn't fly under the CFC program. It has to be focused on personal care and activities of daily living. So that may be something that would apply potentially under a waiver though. So there are some differences with the program. So once again, you just need to talk to the case manager.
Well, if the person's in county services, that we'd be working with DVR and
DVR might be able to supply.
Yeah. If that was necessary for the person to communicate or something, then we would look to VR to help out. Yeah. Or what have.
Mm-hmm. At first, we were having trouble not having enough vendors that could meet the need for the assistive technology.
Yeah. That was a challenge, and right now we have a couple of vendors that are just plowing forward with all kinds of requests and getting us our invoices, and so it's going good. Yeah, I mean, we're continuing to expand that, but right now we're able to meet the need.
Is there someone who, is there an expert in the state in assistive technology that can help identify what assistive technology devices might be available to help meet some of those personal care needs?
For a particular individual?
Yes.
Or in general?
No, for a particular
individual. So one of our requirements in WAC is that the individual that's recommending this piece of assistive tech needs to be familiar with the client or familiar with the individual and know them, know their needs, and know how this particular device is going to be appropriate for them. So hence, a doctor that knows them, a speech-language pathologist that they work with, or an OT they work with, or somebody that knows them related to this device.
But if you had, say, an adult that needed assistance with medication, we know there's a ton of med management stuff out there, right? So, a doctor's going to say, yeah, they need assistance with med management, but they're not going to have the expertise in the different type of assistive technology to know what might be available. Is there somebody there on a state level that can help identify?
I think we would look locally first to see if there's a local individual that would know them or be familiar with that situation. But that, like a medication minder, actually would fall probably more in the PERS. I'll talk about that in a second. But the other pieces, like an iPad for communication related to the activities of daily living, then, you know, we're going to be looking for more likely somebody like a speech language individual they've been working with. But, you know, is there a resource at this point that's statewide or federal?
It's just for adults, there's not a lot of those people that are working with them. And so it's going to end up being something that's more accessible to children than it is to adults. And I see that as a barrier that we're going to need to address in the future.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of assessing what kind of technology will be beneficial to certain people, there's WATAP. I think you've heard of WATAP.
Yeah, but I didn't know if they were connected with them.
But they can do assessment and then recommend what assistive technology would be beneficial. Then they also teach you how to use the assistive whatever they recommend.
And that's a great example.
That's a resource too.
That's a great example. That probably would meet our criteria. Somebody comes in, does an assessment, understands the situation, recommends some, and does some training, that would be actually a pretty good fit.
Let's call it an obstacle instead of a barrier. An obstacle you can get over, a barrier you usually can't.
How much credence is given to, like, the final eligibility evaluation that's done, or IEP, for a student when they're leaving public education, too, as far as what they've been accessing and using as part of their educational program? Does that suffice for a doctor's signature?
Mm-hmm. If it talks specifically about the equipment we're talking
because
about.
Because I know that that's been something that's come up in conversations before, especially as students are transitioning out of public education.
If I had some documentation that was by a professional that related to that individual and that equipment, that may suffice.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Camus could bring that up to special ed directors so that and get it around?
I mean, so Camus could initiate that conversation at the directors meeting
at ESD? Yeah. I mean, somebody's got to tell the schools that it's now there's another reason that their documentation needs to be good. One of it is the eligibility, but now we also have
the opportunities and supports are good.
Yeah.
I can certainly try.
I know where to get this haircut, so I don't have it.
But there's three of them now.
Oh, it's the assistant guy. No, the other one.
All right, continue.
So, next service on the list is the personal emergency response or PERS system. So, most of you would be familiar with that as kind of the help I can't get out kind of button. So, that's an emergency alert system that we can give them access to and get for them. They just need to be someone that lives alone or is alone for significant periods of time to help meet that criteria. And then, one of the cool things about the PERS is there are add-on features. That potentially we could access through that allotment of funds, which would be things like a medication reminder system or something like that, maybe a falls detector or other things that are added onto the basic PERS unit. And so those are things that if that individual, if it's a need area for them, like say falls tracking or medication reminder, that kind of a thing, it can be added into that and used out of those funds.
And finally,
community transition services. So community transition services is service for someone who is a client that's currently transitioning out of a nursing facility or a residential rehabilitation center. If they're transitioning out and they're coming back into the community, into a home, then that community transition service is there to aid in several different ways to assist with that transition. So for example, maybe they have a hospital bed that needs to be transported, you know, by say like a moving company or something, then we would help pay that moving company to get that hospital bed back into that community home. Or if there was some issue with rent or something like that, we may be able to assist with like that deposit or something like that. So those are the CFC services. I would say a large majority of our clients have the CFC service and are eligible for it. So they have access to this stuff, and like I said, they just want to check for their case.
Well, thank you very much, Gary.
Do you have any extra
samples
that came in late?
I don't
know.
Let me see.
I've got one. Thank you.
I think I have some. I think there's probably a few extras.
Extras over at the assignment table.
Okay.
Okay, next then we have Beth Hammer from the Washington Autism Alliance and Advocacy.
Hi.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you. If you don't mind, I am going to sit. Nothing shakes you back, but I've been on it all day, so it's a little sore. thank you for having me. My name is Beth Hammer, and I am the Regional Outreach and Advocacy Coordinator for Washington Autism Alliance and Advocacy. Is my time over now? Yeah, it's a mouthful for what really is a pretty basic, simple premise. WA was started, let me go by WA. I feel like I'm whining when I say that. I work for WA. We were founded in 2007. After the mental health parity law went into effect, our CEO, who has two boys who are on the autism spectrum, realized that even though the mental health parity law said that insurance companies can't cap services, everybody's familiar with the mental health parity law, I don't, right?
Not necessarily in this room.
No? Okay. Well, there's lots of components, but the part that we work with basically is that it said insurance companies cannot cap the number of visits or the amount of money or increased co-pays or anything, increased premiums if something is considered to be medically necessary by a doctor. And what was happening is after this went into effect, the insurance companies pretty much ignored it. So Arzu, our CEO, and several other families were pretty instrumental, and they filed a lawsuit against a couple of the big insurance companies. They won, and part of that was a nice settlement that was to be set aside to help families navigate their insurance and make sure they could maximize using their insurance. So WASP's been around for a while. We have our main offices up in Redmond, but we have advocates in Spokane, Yakima, and now I'm down here in Vancouver. And I cover Clark, Skamania, Cowlitz, Lewis, and Pacific counties. We have a number of resources available. We have a great website that you can go on. There's some great resources there. If you register to become as a member, you can register as a family, an individual, or as a professional. It actually opens up even more resources. There's great sample letters in there that you can use to, you know, maybe get your, a lot of employers and insurance companies are reluctant to release their actual insurance coverage packet. They give you the cute little benefits one that tells you all the glorious, glamorous stuff, but they don't want to give it to them. So there's letters on how to request that. There's letters that you can give to your doctor on how to write a letter to the insurance company deeming something medically necessary, and it quotes all of the laws and all that kind of stuff. So there's lots of resources available. And then we have providers like myself that are really just here to help people navigate in any way we can.
The insurance system.
Anything. Well, I mean, we'll help with anything. And it says autism. However, we're not just dealing with people with autism. It's any developmental disability. So we also have trained advocates who work specifically with IEPs and 504s to help you navigate with that. But our real emphasis is on the insurance piece. That's kind of how my job is funded. We do have a staff attorney who does pro bono insurance denials, appeals for families. So my job is kind of to help the parents get together all the information that they need, and eventually we can turn it over to the attorney. She will walk it through the appeal process if it's exhausted and needs to go to trial. At that point, we back out of it. But the attorney is handed this really nice packet of all the documents they need really to walk into a courtroom. So that's kind of in a nutshell. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm new down here. Oh, these aren't the ones I'm new.
You
I already sent them around.
Agendas.
Those are the agendas.
This way.
We just have to contact you by your. Oh, here, there it is.
It's on there. I'm actually housed Innovative Services Northwest. This just kind of is a one sheet to talk about local services, because otherwise this is the one that we have. And if parents get this and look at what we're doing up in the Seattle area, they're like, oh, look at all these great programs, none of which we have down here as of yet. So I created this one kind of as the local. But this can kind of give you an idea of some of the other services that we're providing up in the Redmond area and starting to branch out into Spokane and Yakima as well. That's it.
Well, thanks. Any more questions?
Yeah.
Darla.
Are you working on the at all as far as building up the provider or lack of provider issues? Did you talk about that?
Have you heard about that? Is that what that? Oh. Actually, I'm kind of excited, and I don't want to say a whole lot because it hasn't happened yet. But I'm working with an organization in hopes of getting some RBTs trained up pretty quick. Registered behavior technician.
Thank you.
So those people can actually work under a board certified behavior analyst, work directly under them, providing direct services, which should allow us to increase the capacity of people providing services pretty quickly. If you guys know anybody who'd be interested in the training, I don't think a lot of people even know it exists, but it's you have to be 18 years old. You have to pass a criminal background check. You have to have a high school diploma or a GED. There is an assessment that you go through, including it's a written, and you go on site with an ABA and they kind of assess you. And then there's a board certified
test that you have to take. The online training that you can do is only 40 hours. And, you know, the starting wage is usually between $16 and $18 an hour, which is not bad for starting in a new field. So we're really working on reaching out to find people that would be interested in that training. And I'm working with another group on possibly ways to pay for the training. Although, actually, if it's something somebody wants to do, I think all-inclusive, it's only about $500 by the time you do the training and take the test. So it's not a really expensive certification. But we're looking for ways that we can actually pay for that and hopefully get at least some RBTs into the field. I have one employer who's committed to hiring. Actually, I have two employers that are committed to hiring. Innovative Services is actually looking for a BCBA, if you want. But
well, and one of the, so there's a lot of controversy right now around the BCBAs because they're not all equal. And so we have a lot of qualified professionals out there doing the work that's not actually doing what needs to be done, and it's looking more therapeutic versus teaching the philosophy and really working toward all of those big, those other issues. Is there anyone targeting that stuff on a state level?
I not that I'm aware of. I can pose that question to Arzu. She would be the one that would know. Okay. And I will, but I don't know. I've actually been in this position about 3 weeks. So I'm learning a lot. My first goal really was to just learn what resources are available in this area, in the five counties that I work with. And it's kind of frightening, the lack of resources. So that's...
There's no lack of miles, though, then.
No lack of miles. I rack up the miles. That's true. Yeah, the more rural you get, the less and more frightening those services become. So
probably really important to connect with Darlene.
I told her I've left her a message and she's been ignoring it. So now she can't because I've announced it to all of you.
Yeah.
But feel free to pass this out, to make copies of it and pass it out to anyone that you think might need it. Don't pass out the flyer because
if
they're looking for a job,
just train.
Yeah, they can.
Okay, what's a BCBA?
Board certified.
And then you have behavior technicians.
Right,
they are
registered behavior. So, right, they're the ones that are actually, you know, from my understanding is, and I'm not one, but a BCBA can actually supervise 3 to 5 RBTs.
Like a team of
so, right. So she goes in, she does the assessments, she writes the plans, she develops what needs to be done, and then she supervises and monitors as that's being implemented. But if we can, you know, put 5 in for every one that we have, and my understanding, and Darla might know better, is that we only have one agency that will take Medicaid, and with one person. So she's pretty overwhelmed right now. Although, like I said, Innovative Services is looking to bring one on, and they do accept Medicaid, so that will open that up a little bit if we can find one.
Isn't there, is that the same issue, place where there's issues?
Yeah.
Okay.
At Innovative, there's issues?
No.
Oh,
no. Different one. Issues. Not, Darla didn't bring them to me. So
okay. And actually, I went online to the group that certifies these folks, and I found, I think, 8 BCBAs that had Vancouver addresses. But of those Vancouver addresses, I only found 4 that actually work in Clark County. The rest work in Portland. So the address that's in there is their home address rather than...
Well, and that didn't used to be the case. We used to have a much more available pool than we currently do.
Do you know a reason for that? Is it wages or what?
No, I would love to have that conversation with you at another time.
Off the record. I think the wages are fairly decent.
Yeah, I was wondering, though.
Seen.
It's not wages.
Because that's often the case with some of our other people who are offering services, isn't it? Yeah.
I know the other agency here in town that offers the ABA therapies, they're not taking Medicaid because of they can't pay for their services. So.
Well, thanks, and I hope someone's advocating for your insurance person.
Yeah, no, that's actually gone very smoothly, believe it or not. That's kind of scary, but it's actually gone very smoothly. If you saw the x-ray, you probably know why they wouldn't deny it. They go, yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Beth, and welcome to Clark County.
Thank you.
Walt, our own Walt Gordon, is going to talk about CSHAN update.
Yeah, I'd like to first thank you, Kristen. Just play you a brief video of how to ride the Vine. That's what we're calling the bus rapid transit. So why don't we play that and answer some questions for you.
With the Vine, CTRAN is launching a new type of public transportation system in the region. It's called Bus Rapid Transit. There are several features that make the Vine different than our normal fixed route bus service. The first thing many people will notice is the bus. At 60 feet long, it's significantly larger than our normal 40-foot buses. The vehicle is also articulated, allowing it to bend in the middle as it maneuvers around corners. As with any vehicle, it's important to be safe around the Vine's buses. Keep your eyes and ears open. Keep a safe distance from the bus when it's in motion. And keep in mind that the bus may swing out wide while making a turn. The bus is also equipped with audible alarms for added safety. On the platform, ticket vending machines will allow passengers to pay fares before stepping onto the bus. The platforms themselves are built level with the floor of the bus, allowing wheelchairs and bikes to roll on with ease. And remember, if you have a monthly pass, there's no need to use the ticket vending machine. You're already good to go. Once you're on board, the regular rules of riding apply. Remain seated or hang on to the handrails while the bus is moving. If you're near the pivot point in the middle of the bus, watch your step. The floor will rotate during a turn, which can create an unusual sensation if you're not used to it. As you ride the Vine, you'll notice other features that set it apart from a regular bus line. Two Q jumps will give the Vine a leg up on traffic. At these locations, a special signal will allow the bus to go first, a few seconds before the light turns green for other traffic. For added safety, we've also installed new pedestrian crossings at multiple sites on the corridor. All of these ingredients combine to form a system that's more quick, efficient, and reliable than regular bus service. Enjoy the ride.
If you go to catchthevine.com, there's also another YouTube video that talks about how people with mobility devices can use the Vine. It's a big project. It's a $53 million project that, thankfully, here in Clark County, we only had to pay 20% of. The rest of it was with Federal Transit Administration funds. And if you've gone down Fort Vancouver Way or McLaughlin or actually Fourth Plain, you'll see some of our stations that are coming to life, so to speak. So the kickoff, and if you have one or both of these handouts, it'll give you a little bit of extra information, but the service will begin January 8th, which is a Sunday.
I don't have the other one.
You don't have the other one? And so we're going to celebrate everything because this has been a multi-year project on Saturday, January 7th. And then the following day, we're going to kick the program off. The estimation is that we're going to be able to provide 10-minute frequency service along the Fourth Plain Corridor. And by doing so, we get into a realm of you really don't need schedules because the bus will come to such a frequency that you don't have to worry about knowing what the schedules are. If you just got to that stop sometime between 0 and 10 minutes, you're going to get picked up by
during rush hour, I mean during the whole day, or
that's part of the reason for what you saw is the queue jumps for the vehicles, so that we won't be stopped because of lighting, you know, red lights. What will happen is actually the way the queue jump works is that, let's say it's a green light, it's a stale green light. As the vehicle comes in close proximity to it, the system will know to hold that green light until the vehicle passes through. All of our stops are on the far side. So it gives a little bit of an edge. And then also the level boarding and the fact that you don't pay on the bus at all is another feature that speeds up what we call dwell time, or the amount of time it takes to board a bus or disembark from a bus. One of the things that's interesting about this particular vehicle is that of the three securement stations for mobility devices, two of which are called passive rear-facing devices. And what's different about that is that the customer can come in, they can back up against what we call the surfboard or padded board, and an arm comes down to the side and off they go. They don't need to be secured to the bus the same way as a person with a mobility device that's forward facing. That's because when the bus stops, your momentum is going to go up against the surfboard, and if it turns, you're going to be coming up against the securement arm or the side of the bus. They have this at Lane Transit in Eugene. They also have it with Community Transit in Snohomish County. And what they have found is that the majority of mobility device users prefer the passive system over the forward facing. But that's probably one of the biggest changes you're going to see, other than the fact that the dang thing moves or pivots in the middle. So we're really excited about that. We're going to have Veronica Marty, myself, and some others do travel training for folks starting on January 3rd. With the week of January 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th, we'll be taking students from the transition programs, from the School for the Blind, School for the Deaf, and citizens that want to learn how to ride the Vine, giving them training so that they feel comfortable, and starting on day one, they can start using the Vine. Now, I've heard that there's a rumor going around that TriMet is taking over C-Trans, and that's not true. If anybody says that to them, I want you to point your index finger, that's this one, remember, it's this one, right in their face and say, no, because it's not true. It can't by law. C-Tran is a public transportation benefit area agency, and Washington state law doesn't allow us to have Portland interlopers and Oregonians with their web feet come across the river. I mean, they can visit, spend their money, but they have to go home at the end of the day. Yes, unless they get one of our expensive hotels.
You have some strong views on this?
A little bit.
So when are we going to start seeing these BMN vehicles navigating our roadways? Sounds like before the actual launch day.
Yeah, you're going to see them because they're training right now. Yeah. We have to train all of our drivers, all 102 drivers.
Where do the buses come from?
They come from Minnesota.
Minnesota.
They're called New Flyers. And they're the only ones in that meet the requirement for a Made in America. And so because they're 80% federally funded, they have to be made in America, or at least assembled in America. New Flyer used to be a Canadian company. And I think they moved to Minnesota just so they could get more, you know, contracts in the United States. With that, I can answer any questions right now. Hold on a second, I'll tell you what the score is. It was it's actually kind of 1-1.
That would be a good
deal in soccer. Yeah, it would be. Let me see. Hold on. Score still 1-1. The Indians score a run in the bottom of
the third. The regional pass is perhaps why people thought folks were merging. Is that?
Well, the e-fare program, which has the regional pass, is going to come online mid-2017. First with fixed route buses, and that's a tap-on, tap-off. If you can imagine a gift card to Applebee's, for lack of a better way of saying it, where you can reload it. You can do it by means of the internet, or you can go to a retail outlet, have them reload the card, and you tap on. It automatically deducts from your account how much the fare is. If you are an honored citizen, for example, it will give you the discount, because it will know that it's Darla and she's entitled to X discount. And so the fare increase we had in September, which was the only fare increase, was to come into line with the disabled pass fare that TriMet had with what we had. So we had to actually increase it so it was the same price. And that's only for rides that will cross Clark County, meaning if you only travel within Clark County, the fare hasn't really increased. But if you go from Clark County to Portland and Portland and back, that fare is increased to the regional fare.
I think it's probably a political conspiracy theory.
What?
Well, a number of our fare committee members wear tin hats.
Yeah.
I never could understand it.
Okay.
Well, you said, so I saw in the video how to buy the ticket or whatever, but if you've got a pass, you just get on and get off. So how are they tracking who's paid and who hasn't paid?
What they'll have is fare inspectors, like what you've seen on TriMet Light Rail.
Okay.
And they'll be independently checking people periodically in
random. So random.
So are they, those fare inspectors, are they going to be trained in approaching individuals who might be on a certain spectrum that might need to be approached a little differently?
Yes, they will be trained. They're nothing like the TriMet experience of a couple of days ago. And, quote, there was a fare inspector that didn't believe a woman was blind. It made KDT news. But no, what I'm going to suggest, it just came to me right now, is working with the project lead and say that with the contracted employees we have, maybe we'll contact Mary about getting some sensitivity training, those kinds of things.
February. David's coming in February.
Okay.
If you would like to have some time.
Can you tentatively pencil that in, and then I'll work with the project manager about that.
Okay. Is this working?
Well,
okay.
I want to stay for your, I have to leave now. So Leanne will take over.
Any questions?
I think.
Okay.
Okay.
Excuse me.
No questions for Walt? Thank you, Walt.
Yeah, thank you.
Always learn. I think I'm just going to take the bus just to go on one of the bendy kind, just for the fun of riding. Mm-hmm. These are not new. My parents had them in Seattle years ago, and they would take my children when they were small on articulated buses. Mm-hmm. That was the big outing to go downtown on an articulated, mm-hmm. But that's 30 years ago.
Oh yeah,
so these
articulated buses are new, and that's the thing about bus rapid transit. It's taking technology and trying to marry it with light rail, so you don't have the capital expenditure and the inflexibility of a light rail system, but you have some of the benefits of light rail with a vehicle that's on rubber tires. So if we wanted to change the route, we could with these buses and still have the advantage of the bus rapid transit.
Yeah, it is fun.
That's
all right. Our next item then is grant news. So, what's this?
Can we start?
Yes.
With this?
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
The rest. Well, Tim was supposed to talk about that.
Okay. So, I wanted to give an update about our Roads to Community Living grants that we have received. We received many grants, not in the form of money, but in the form of compensation and services that we've kind of worked with other contractors in the state of Washington. So in 2015, you might recall that we had a mini grant that was about person-centered planning. And person-centered planning, you'll recall, is something that we've been very invested in here in Clark County and in the state of Washington and around the country that helps people and the people who care about the individuals with disabilities to get focused and plan for the future and come together and have a process around doing that. So we had a mini grant that allowed us to do a focus group with person centered facilitators, person centered planning facilitators here in Clark County with customers and families. And we also had an advisory counselor that made recommendations back to the state about, around person centered planning. And the reason for this mini grant and kind of a renewed interest on the state's part is that now person centered planning is service that can be accessed through DDA services. And so the state is interested, well, and it's a Medicaid requirement. So the state is interested in kind of building back up the cadre of personal planners that are able to provide these services for their customers.
Clark has developed a little differently. It's really developed expertise in the school teachers that are willing to do it beyond their schools, and that's unique in our state that it would be teachers. Hi, Susan.
Hey.
Yeah.
Part of the A team.
We've had a person centered planning teacher training for the past 10 years, 9 years?
Yeah, around that long.
So we've got some capacity there. In July of 2016, we started a new teacher cohort, which was actually has been teachers and family members who were interested in learning about person-centered planning. And this was also funded by Roads to Community Living. Roads to Community Living is a state-funded grant that is funded with state and federal money that's designed to help people that are moving from institutions or to keep people out of institutional settings. So we had the mini grant, the teacher training, and we have just received, well, in February of 2016, we had a mini grant for employment services, and that grant targeted three individuals to do person-centered planning and some additional hours of either discovery or job development. And the goal of this mini grant was to get people employed. So it was a very, very short period of time. It just went from February till June. And we were able to report out on some of our activities, but we've just recently gotten approval to kind of continue on that grant through the remainder of this fiscal year, which ends at the end of June. And so for those three people, they received person-centered plans and some additional hours of discovery or job development services. This built on the work that the previous technical assistance we had received from Michael Callahan, people like Michael Callahan, Val Morgan, and the like. So is that what you wanted me to do? Is that good? Any questions on our roads to community living, person-centered planning? It's been fun, kind of innovative projects to try some new and different things with people.
Thanks, Trish.
Thank you.
Next time is the October event report, and Ted's supposed to get it, and Ted's gone.
Anybody want to talk about the event on the 19th?
I thought that's why the computer was set up to show the pictures.
We could. Oh, they're on there.
The well, it's, is that what? It, no, not the video. Just the slides, oh. The pictures that...
Oh, would you like me to show the slides next time or something?
Well, they have nice pictures. I sure were joyful.
Yeah, okay. We can do that. No, because some of them, there's a couple that aren't great.
Image.
And one woman who's scrunching up her face. So,
Francesca?
I can't remember who. But yeah, we can do that next time.
And it was a wonderful event. Mm-hmm.
Everybody loved it.
How many people? I mean, I was trying to guess
about it. We were standing room only in the back.
Yeah.
Right. And so there were, the chairs were set up for 280, and pretty much had that or very close to that.
280?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Mark McCauley's been getting random emails from families, which I think that's just absolutely great. And he's been happy about that, so that's
random emails looking for employment or
no, being happy about the
event
not realizing that he was as involved as he is, you know, that was one comment, I think. So I've been saving those comments that because he passes them on.
I just think every year it gets better, and because I can remember starting out and we could, you know, we were happy if we kind of filled the room, and now it's like if you don't get the room, you don't get a seat,
right.
Which I think is wonderful to show what our community has been doing with employment.
If anybody doesn't familiar, it's the National Disability Employment Awareness Month, and so every October, the board, along with Vancouver Chamber of Commerce, plans this celebration event, and it's really fun, and employers are honored, and employees are honored, and with the new award this year, professionals in the field are honored. David's award. Umpqua Bank just called Wise and wanted to help sponsor out of the blue.
Oh, really?
So that was kind of, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Now your award comes with a savings bond.
Well, that would have been nice. But they did pay for the interpreters, which we really appreciate.
Yeah. And New Seasons has been.
Yeah, a great rose arrangements. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a great event. And then another one that was really well attended that I went to, and Darla's going to talk to us about, is the Candidates Forum report.
So I brought a couple of the binders that went out to the candidates, just so if anybody wanted to see kind of what the candidates receive ahead of time. It was on the 25th, and it was at Clark College. We ended up with about 240 participants. There was 20 candidates at the meet and greet, 19 up on stage, and we've been contacted by about 8 of the candidates since then to follow up on different things and to send us thank yous and like how can they get more involved, do they want more information, those kinds of things, which is we're always happy to provide. So CBTV had recorded it, so here on this card is the address for the CBTV link, as well as to Fraley Photography, who does all of the photographs. So on here you can get access to the video as well as the pictures if you would like. And then here is the disability reception, legislative reception flyer.
I think people got,
this year we did the, I don't know if anybody noticed, but we actually did the questions different than we had done before for previous candidates forms. In the past, we would give them a list of questions and all the backup documentation, and they got to choose which question they were going to ask, answer, and then they had got to respond to the question that their opponent chose as well. This year, the two candidates had to answer the same question, and we chose randomly out of the fishbowl. So they really needed to be prepared for all the questions, and we were available to them ahead of time if they chose to take advantage of that. And we did provide them the information and documentation, and it was pretty clear when you watched the forum who really had studied and who had paid attention and who had not, which is always interesting. And we had candidates that stayed. We had staff that was there until 10:30 that night, so it was pretty amazing. But anyway, just wanted to thank everybody for their support and their help in getting it through again.
Wonderful. I really like, Darla, how you had the questions up on screens. So as they were giving their answers, I could remind myself of the question, because sometimes, you know, the questions are longer, or with their answer, you'd be like, you know, you could stay focused on what the question was to begin with. So I really like that visual. And then, aside from the candidates, my favorite part of the evening was a speaker that you brought in, Johanna?
Ivanova.
Yeah. Ivanova.
Ooh, yeah.
Powerful, powerful, powerful speaker. And not only so accomplished in living with disability, but when it was said, I live in an
in an institution. She called it an institution. I'm like, in prison. I was in prison. And this was after she'd been speaking for a while, so everybody was already on the edge of their seats listening. So everybody was already on the edge of their seats listening. And when that was, I don't think there was anyone in the room that wasn't touched by it. And certainly all the candidates were very, you could tell, you could just look across and see that they were all very affected by the speech and the information. And I thought it was a brilliant part. So if you can catch this, downloaded, I would watch it.
Especially if you haven't voted, because there is, it was clear who, there were a couple that didn't answer remotely the question that was given.
And, you know, Ivanova was amazing, and if you paid attention to the video at the end, she's in that video saying, I am a professor. Right. Uh-huh. I lived in an institution for 5 years, and now I'm a professor. I mean, that's, we started with the institution, we ended with the I'm a professor. We also had a dance team that was a multicultural, multi-diversity dance team that came in that was actually individuals who experienced disabilities that did a dance prior. And those were, that was one of the projects that came out of our FOLA Foundations of Leadership and Advocacy group that graduated in May, I believe they graduated. And so this is one of the community projects, is that they're doing this inclusive multicultural dance training for individuals, and they're always looking for places to perform. So
cool.
That was kind of the meaning of that as well.
Okay, this is going to be quick. So this is, I wrote up a little more, and I will clean it up because I see two typos. The legislative agenda that you voted on last September. If you guys have not, I'm not going to be changing what you voted on, but if you have any wordsmithing kinds of things, beyond that, please let me know. And then, did you still want to meet with legislators in January, that first week? Or,
yeah, you can. Let me know the timing.
Well, we have been doing it the first week in January.
Well, I mean, the time of day, because typically it's coffee at 10.
Oh, yeah. Well, whenever they're available, which is kind of dicey sometimes.
I'll be available for some of those.
Really. Sure.
We have to try and stay away from committee meetings and things like that. But,
there's no, it's not really.
Now, the governor, the DSHS budget has no cut on it. But, you know, we always have to watch for that.
Sorry, the DSHS, their budget, their submission?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably because they didn't, the governor didn't ask for any.
No, they put it in their maintenance budget, even I think some transition stuff, but that, there's no guarantee, because that would be new money, I think. So the transition is, and housing is an issue for everyone. And so I made it kind of vague because, you know, we need a lot of different things depending on the people that are needing housing. Some people need more support than others, but everybody needs affordable housing. So that's why I wrote it like that. But if you guys have more words on that one, I'm open.
Should the transition statement read, the bottom read, transitioning from public education or transitioning from special education?
Public special education?
Public special.
Oh. Or I can just say public education.
Yeah.
I like that better. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. I'll change that. And I'll zip it out to you again. Because I have those other corrections.
Three to one.
Any new business? Okay.
So we're adjourned?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Daniel, I wanted to thank you.